Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
You're listening to The Dialogue with Diwa de Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text us your thoughts on 2057 or email your questions to inbox@realitycheck.radio. We are joined now by New Zealand historian and author Keith Newman. Welcome to the show, Keith.
Kia ora, Diwa.
And before we get into the questions about New Zealand history, especially early New Zealand history, and the role that the missionaries played, could you give us a little bit of a history about yourself and why you ended up writing books about the missionaries and the treaty in early New Zealand history?
I think my own ignorance forced me to it. I became aware that I was not aware of the richness of our own history, and I started researching the Māori prophet Tahu Pōtiki Weremu Ratana, and that was a 20-year process, and it just woke me up to how rich our history was and how little I knew about it, and how little I'd picked up at school, whether that was my own inattention or whether it was just something that I hadn't grasped with a passion. But these days, I'm absolutely passionate about understanding the context of our New Zealand history. I'm a journalist with probably 40-something years under my belt, working for mainstream and trade media, and this has become my passion, really, to try and fill in what I think are some of the gaps in our history in Aotearoa.
The interesting thing about your book, which I read, and you published it in 2010, it's not that fresh. Well, I guess it's quite a new book in the landscape of books about New Zealand history, and it's subtitled Missionaries Among the Māori, A New Perspective. And what drove you to write this new perspective? Why was there a need for a new perspective, in your opinion?
Well, our history, I think, had been recorded in a very fragmented way. And I wanted to understand, for example, whether there was any truth in the old cliche that, while Māori were reading the Bible, the colonists came in and stole the land out from underneath them, and discovered that that was a fairly fanciful cliche that has been used in many contexts. And I didn't find that. I thought, I went to the publisher at the time, Reed and Penguin, and said I wanted to write it, and they were really concerned because I had a Christian faith, and then, mind you, the publisher was a Buddhist, and I explained to them that, you know, my integrity as a journalist is involved here. I wouldn't want to skew things. This is not a hagiography. This is something that I was really passionate to do. And he said to me at the time, well, actually, we've been wanting to do something like this for some while, so go for it. And that was really good. I'd already published the route in a book at that stage, so I was amping to know more about our own history and wanting to go right back to before Samuel Marsden and just bring it forward as much as I could. Ended up being two books, actually. The second one, Beyond Betrayal, covers off from the 1860s onwards in a more detailed fashion. I had to stop before we got pretty much very much past the land wars.
Yeah, I noticed that in the book that you mentioned, you had to stop by 1860, which is where things got interesting. And I unfortunately don't have your second book, but I'll have to get that at some stage and have a read of it and get your opinion on the later stage. But the earlier part of New Zealand history before those wars was fascinating to me, having learned just at school, roughly focused around the events of 1840 and the Treaty of Waitangi. But you actually start much earlier than that, as you mentioned, the first settlement. And this was new for me too. I wasn't that long ago when I went through school, but the first settlement was actually in 1814. And you kind of go into the lead up of that as well. So how did this first European settlement come about? How did the missionaries end up putting a settlement down? And, you know, what were Maori up to at that time as well? Because that was quite fascinating too. I thought they were just sitting in New Zealand, but that wasn't really the case, was it?
No. I mean, it was anarchy, really. There was no rule of law. There were whalers and sealers and traders and, just arriving in the ships and there was a lot of advantage taken of Māori hospitality, a lot of forest cut down, a lot of goods taken without payment, a lot of wahine used and abused. And it was really in Kororareka in the far north, became known as the hellhole of the Pacific. And it was really Māori who went New South Wales to Samuel Marsden and asked, you know, would you send a missionary to teach the children principally? But a lot of Māori had already gone overseas and were exploring and knew the world was changing dramatically, but they weren't very happy. They were asking for some sort of policing of the behaviour of British citizens in the far north that was getting out of control. And they thought perhaps the missionaries may bring part of that kind of control to that situation. But, you know, there were multiple encounters with missionaries like Ruatara, had been rescued in London in 1909 by Samuel Marsden after being dumped off there and not paid for his work on the ships because he was a real explorer. And Marsden and his wife took Ruatara, who was a far north chief, back to Parramatta, nursed him back to health because he was on the point of death, gave him trees, sheep, modern implements, encouraged him in the ways of farming, and he became the liaison. As did Te Pahi in the far north until he got killed unintentionally. He had also been a liaison at that point. All the trade stopped for a while because there was a lot of fear, and those relationships had to be built back together again as Marsden kind of came and brokered peace even before that 1814 sermon with those people who had killed Te Pahi and had burned the boy. So that's a whole nother story, but he went and brokered forgiveness before he went to preach the message at Weehee Bay on Christmas Day 1814. So, yeah.
And it seemed like there were quite a few humanitarians in the British Foreign Office as well in the next few decades between 1814 and 1840. Could you tell us a little bit about the influence as well? I think they were known as the Clapham sect, William Wilberforce, and then so on. And they were quite influential, and they tried to bring a new approach to dealing with the natives of New Zealand.
Well, absolutely. And Wilberforce was a mentor to Samuel Marsden before he came out to Australia as the chaplain and judge, which was a bit of a conflict of roles. But he'd been encouraging him to engage in humanitarian principles, including how Pacific Islanders and Māori were treated aboard the ships. But Wilberforce's own mentor was Newton, who'd been a slave ship captain, and he had gone to him at one stage. He ran a church in the middle of England somewhere, and he was thinking, well, I'm a Christian, I'm a parliamentarian, I've got a fairly responsible job here. I'm not sure that the two roles are aligned. You know, there's a conflict here. And John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, said to him, you stay exactly where you are because you can have an influence. So Wilberforce ended up dedicating the rest of his life to ending the slave trade. So Wilberforce's son-in-law, I think it was James Stephen Jr., was working in the Colonial Office as an advisor, and he wrote the instructions to Lord Normanby for the Treaty of Waitangi, saying, you know, we can't continue to do what we've done to other nations as we've colonised them, because look at the damage that's been done to Indigenous people. We just cannot do that anymore. We've got colonies enough. If we're going to have any kind of relationship in New Zealand, it's got to be done in conjunction with, in relationship with the Māori people, because they already have a settled form of government, and they're an agricultural people, so we need to respect that and work with them. So this was pre-1840 when discussions were going on about how to deal with New Zealand, because Britain wasn't really interested, but the risk was that the French were coming, and the risk was, again, that Māori was saying, you need to start looking after your own people because there's chaos here and they're causing all sorts of problems. So somewhere in between there, the missionaries, the Clapham sect people began to negotiate, and when it was decided that a treaty should be signed, a lot of discussions went on ahead of that.
And one of the things that I picked up from what happened after the treaty was signed, especially, like, it seemed like the key clause actually was perhaps around the monopoly on buying land. That seemed to be quite a key thing for the British government. And I saw even a New Zealand commentator, Chris Trotter, wrote the other week that he, at least his view was that the third article of the treaty was sort of a sop that was thrown to the humanitarians, and that the key part of the treaty was really about British government, the governor being able to buy land in New Zealand. And that was, I guess, was there that real tension there between what the missionaries wanted and what the governor, the settlers and so on wanted?
Yeah, it comes back to interpretation. I think there were some pretty unscrupulous early officials within the New Zealand government who were indeed out for their own interests. And it really wasn't until about 1847 that the clarification of law about the first right of purchase was placed into legislation. And that sort of borrowed from North America. And, you know, and Governor Gray did do a bit of test case, but the preemptive clause really meant that instead of land speculators, and there were plenty of them before the treaty, and it put an end to private land purchases. So everything had to go through the government if and when Māori decided to sell. And that was the issue too, because there was an awful lot of pressure on Māori to sell, and Māori not being particularly au fait with the bureaucracy and the paperwork and all the legislative nonsense that goes on, were often duped into making arrangements that were sort of beyond their understanding. And some of those breaches of the treaty happened pretty early on, and they continued apace, of course. But yeah, I think there were some unscrupulous dealings, definitely. But if the letter of the law had been stuck to and the treaty had been honoured, Māori would have had a voice. But that voice was denied pretty early on when the British assumed that they had the right to do far more than what was agreed.
One of the things that I've seen with history, that the way that it gets taught, is that missionaries are basically cut out of the story today, with what is, in my opinion, revisionist. I think your opinion as well. You say that in the book, that revisionist history basically cuts out the missionaries. And I remember even just over a decade ago, 2012, I think, in studying at the Manukau Institute of Technology, we had to do a course on the treaty. And the lecturer basically suggested that the missionaries just wanted all the land for themselves. Sort of the missionaries were trying to dupe Māori into the treaty. It was all a trick, and the missionaries wanted all this land. That seemed to be, I don't know if that's continues to be the case, but that was when I was at university, that's what was taught as like the authentic history of New Zealand.
Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate. I mean, if you look at how much land the missionaries actually ended up with, it was very little. And poor old Henry Williams got debarred from the Church Missionary Society because the governor and the bishop conspired against him. But, you know, he had a crap piece of land and he made the most of it. And he supplied and worked alongside Māori, even with a broken heart after that. But, you know, the missionaries didn't end up with a lot of land. And I think, unfortunately, the suggestion that Henry Williams purposefully misinterpreted the treaty still hangs around a bit. And that comes from some of Ruth Ross's early papers that really skewed academic history a lot, I think. But if you look at the man, these missionaries gave up everything to come out to Aotearoa, to a strange land, to a strange people, learn the language, sat with the people, and really, I think, had their best interests at heart. They weren't complicit with colonialism or with the government. They were working independently as part of the Church Missionary Society to be missionaries, to get alongside the people, knowing that change was coming rapidly, and to help to try and equip them with agriculture and every tool and means that they could. And I think if we cut that out of the story, then we've just got a history of militarism. And it's an awkward, uncomfortable history. But if you put the missionaries in, you actually put some human relationships back into the picture. And really, I don't think the treaty would have been signed at all if it hadn't been for the missionaries convincing Māori that it was in their best interests. In fact, Moniheki said afterwards, when Colenso challenged, saying, do Māori fully understand what they're doing? And Hunihiki, the first to sign, stood up and he said, well, if we don't, the missionaries will explain it to us. And I think that gives the church a sense of, well, should do anyway, a sense of responsibility for still being party to this. And I think that's why this letter recently of 440 signatories from church leaders saying a bit of tie ho, hang on a minute here for this principles of the treaty bill, because we still want to be custodians and guardians of what happens here, because this is about relationship, and this covenant or this kawanata is about how we do this together into the future. It's not a legal document in the sense that it's been treated in so many cases with lawyers arguing over those four paragraphs forever. This is about building relationship, or kotahitanga, or how can we heiwi tahi tato, not the Don Brash version. How can we do this together? How can we make a great nation out of this? And I think we're at that point where that discussion is really important right now.
Oh, absolutely. But before we get into that, I think as we were talking about Henry Williams, the thing that really struck me with the way that Henry Williams is portrayed in history versus what really happened, and you tell that story really well. The really big example, I think, is when Onaiheke does his Flagstaff protest, his little rebellion, gets in a fight with the government. And then you see that he is on good terms with Henry Williams. He goes and visits his house. He doesn't burn down his property. He goes and visits him and he leaves. And that seemed to make the governor a little bit upset. And you see that Henry Williams sort of gets accused of being a bit treasonous. And that seems to be the version that's seeped into the history books. So there's like, oh, Henry Williams was a bit treasonous. And that seems to be what gets taught from the other side. But really, if you look at the Maori side of how they actually lived, they were very, very good friends with him. They had no objections with him. They had no beef with him. And just to have that completely cut out of history, like you said, then it really becomes a conflict between the governor, the settlers, and the Maori. And you miss out, like you said, those beautiful human stories that you had with the missionary sitting in the middle of it.
Yeah, I mean, you just go to the Waitangi Museum and or look at the monument that's there that Māori paid for themselves, calling him the father of what was happening at the time. And you know, of course, Onaiheke would turn up with a Bible under his arm sometimes and believe that cutting down the flagpole was part of doing God's work. Maybe it was the replacement by, you know, as the flagpole of kotahitanga. And all the talk was, how can we people do this together as a brotherhood, as a coming together? Even the treaty petition that was signed in 1832, all about how can we do this together as a brotherhood, as two peoples working together towards, and Māori very, very gracious even today, really, at this point in the debate.
And what do you think would have happened then if the missionaries didn't do the work they did, the changes that they had on Maori society, the change they had on the way that warfare was conducted? What would have happened? The treaty, you know, say the missionaries weren't there, the treaty wasn't signed. What kind of outcome would we have had?
Well, all of this happened in the middle of the musket wars. And all right, Kendall was instrumental, unfortunately, in bringing about 300 muskets into the country after Hongihika sold the armor and whatever was given to him when he went to visit the king. And Kendall kind of brokered that deal. You know, the missionaries were kind of caught in a bit of a bind, but, you know, Māori were getting muskets every way that they could, and there was a lot of utu going on. And it really was Henry Williams, the former naval officer, who was able to gain sufficient mana to be able to stand between a lot of these chiefs and say, hang on a minute, there's got to be another way. He'd spoken to a number of them about the peaceful gospel, about forgiveness, and he was trying to reason with them and say, if you continue to do this, you'll kill each other's sons, you won't have a future. Let's focus on trade. Let's focus on how you can get back to your gardens and actually do well as a nation. And they listened to him and they respected him. If it hadn't been for people like him, I don't know, the musket wars would have probably continued on for some time further. And I imagine any friendly negotiations about a treaty may not have happened, certainly in the way that they did.
And you've mentioned already just before the treaty is a covenant, and that seems to come up as well in the letters of the Kohi Maramara Conference in 1860. But this seems to be relegated to the view of Māori, that to view this as a sacred covenant. Could you explain that a little bit more and why it basically doesn't really appear in British sources, right? You see the British side, especially the New Zealand government, tries to sort of shove the treaty aside, especially for a while. It basically becomes less relevant to the New Zealand government and becomes more relevant to Māori.
Yeah, I mean, the Governor General in the 1840s, the Chief Justice earlier on in the picture, they all used the term covenant because it was something that was understood by Māori. I mean, the New Testament was a covenant. It's a reciprocal arrangement that requires mutual respect. And as Alistair Rees has recently said, it was like a love letter that requires both parties to engage mutually. It's like a marriage. You know, you've got to give and you've got to take. It's not a literal, legal, hardwired statement that the courts can forever battle. If you, even if they did and you haven't got relationship, then you've got a relationship that's stuffed, haven't you? What we really need to be considering is, what does this relationship look like? What is the how can we work together as two people? And that was the implication right from the beginning. Māori inviting Pākehā in an official way to come and be part of the country, and Māori in turn being given equal rights as British citizens with the protection for their treasures and their land and all the rest of it, which is what the treaty was. So there was supposed to be lots of give and take. But the take came from one side and there was very little giving back. In other words, Māori still today saying, well, hang on a minute, we're supposed to be partners, and that doesn't mean a percentage as in a business relationship. It means, how can we do this together? And if Māori are not given the voice to be able to have a say in the issues that are happening that affect their nation, whether it's tribally or together, then those grievances still sit today. If with the right relationship, we can move together. And really, this Māori could lead us economically into an incredible future, considering their economy is worth about $60 billion. So here we are all this time later still arguing over tino rangatiratanga and what that means. And, you know, you've got Mr. Seymour trying to say, oh, we've all got tino rangatiratanga. Well, who's going to decide what he says, the iwi and hapu rights are protected back to the time of the treaty? Well, who's going to decide exactly what those rights were? He's just put us back into the legal realm of the courts having to decide again. So it's this whole business of the treaty principles bills got very messy and unnecessary at a time when we don't need that as a country, I think.
There's a very interesting part in the treaty principles bill, which basically says iwi and hapu had different rights that the treaty was supposed to protect, and that they should negotiate any differences with the Crown, that, you know, any kind of agreements, any treaty settlements and so on, they should do that with the Crown, which seems to be what has been happening. Is there sort of it seems like the bill is not going ahead, but is that a view from Seymour saying that iwi and hapu should negotiate with the Crown? I mean, that sort of seems to be the solution, really, like without it being related to the courts and different parts of legislation, at the end of the day, it comes down to how these things are negotiated and with the government.
Yeah, well, that's what the Waitangi Tribunal was supposed to be about, wasn't it? So, I mean, it's going to be very interesting. It's an unfortunate impasse that we've reached here at a time where Māori are really concerned that so much of what they've achieved over the past decades looks to be challenged. I think some of the principles of the treaty do need to be clarified. There's just so much incorporated into so many public documents that it is a little bit confusing. I'm not against that, but I just wonder whether some of these things get pushed through and we end up with an entirely different outcome than is good for either party. What we're seeing right now, as you well know, is this Huia Motu will now go down to Naitahu in the South Island. This is Māori uniting, calling for kotahitanga. And if we've got a single voice, what's the government going to do? Ignore it? I don't think it can. I think this is time for a discussion about national identity. And maybe John Key's flying of the flag all those years ago was a preemptive move. It was back to front as far as I'm concerned. We should decide who we are, where we're going, how we're going to work together before we decide to fly a flag over it. It is an intersection in time that's going to be really important for this country, but Māori need to be at the table. They need to be part of, I mean, they discussed for 250 hui around the country to come up with the Matiki Mai document, which was their aspirations for 2040 for constitutional reformation. what a great beginning to a conversation that the government and the rest of us could have got involved in. Instead, we go, oh, no, you can't do that. Well, without a vision, the Bible says people wander aimlessly. I think it's time to have a vision. And Māori have already started the conversation. So maybe we need to get with it, get part of it, and just see where it takes us. This could be an exciting time or a very disruptive time.
The previous government had put forward ideas and was, you know, moving forward with the words co-governance, partnership, and there was controversy around, say, giving ownership or co-ownership of water assets and other bits and pieces. And that seemed to have really electrified things. The election basically hinged on those issues. So they did become very polarizing issues. Is there a realistic way where sort of we step back from that polarization where you just have every single election be one about the treaty and race relations, as they call it? It seems like we're trapped on both sides, neither of which wants to back down. And as you say, it's a good time to have a discussion and come up with something that works for everyone. But it seems like we're moving further away from people sitting down and coming up with a reasonable solution that makes everyone happy.
Yeah, I think we're too small a nation to be having these discussions at continually at local authority level. Local authorities have run out of money. They're taxing the heck out of ratepayers, and they can't even get on with the infrastructure issues. So there needs to be a much higher level decision on how we can move ahead, with central government giving local government at least permission or support or funding to be able to get that infrastructure correct. And if we've got to have a single decision about water, rather than putting it back onto individual councils, which looked like it was heading that way. But the ridiculous thing with all of these changes is the bureaucratic cost, buying new buildings, hiring executives, and a great amount of funding, and then having to back off it. Man, we've been on a seesaw for far too long. So I think that kōrero with Māori about kotahitanga, how can we do this together, is way overdue. Otherwise, it's just going to get stalled and stalled until Māori feel that they're heard, and until all the various parties realise perhaps that politically we're too small to have all of these back and forward conversations. We're going to run out of money, and it's all going to fall back on the taxpayer, and local authorities just can't afford to keep up with this and need some clear direction. A central government has not given clear direction on coastal hazards, which I've been involved in, and in so many other areas. It's been allowed to be such a disparate, disruptive process. Conversations overdue. Māori have started it. What are the principles of the treaty that we can embody, embrace, get excited about, that bring us together as a people with hope for the future? Right now, in this disruption, I worry that if the right conversations aren't had, when Māori do have a voice, it will be something that comes as a roar rather than a wise consultation.
And there seems to be a big push then from David Seymour and Don Brash, especially on saying, well, we're a modern, liberal, multi-ethnic democracy. We need to put aside special treatment. You know, everybody needs to be treated the same. And these agreements that were made in the past, they're not really relevant to enough New Zealanders. And that seems to be getting worse as well, right? So we're stuck in this situation where it seems like there's nobody's going to back down, and that some things will keep rolling along until something bad happens.
Yeah, I mean, all I can go back to is that statement that was made by Hobson to the early chiefs who signed the treaty, he iwi tahi tato, which means we two peoples can do this together. And it's also from the scriptures that comes from the one that says breaking down the walls of division between us, which to me is ko tahitanga. How can we do this together? How can we get around the table and have a conversation about what makes Aotearoa New Zealand shine down here at the edge of the world? We're such an entrepreneurial people. We're ready to go. I think we've got so much to offer, but there's so much bureaucracy. There is so much box ticking. There are so many people wanting their way that there's got to be a much more ambassadorial approach. And maybe this generation of Māori leaders can show us a way forward, including Ngā Waihono I Te Pō, the new Māori Queen, or the new head of the Ratana Church. These guys are all coming together for the first time in a long time, and they're agreeing on a way forward. They're talking about unity. How do we get unity when you've got so much polarization in Parliament? Maybe there needs to be a multi-party agreement to determine how we can, in fact, navigate our way through these choppy seas, and as the Māori proverb says, feel the spray of the future refreshing us as it splashes us in the face.
Interesting to see then these different Māori groups and tribes working together as well, because we see that in early New Zealand history, they were arch enemies in many ways. Every tribe was pitted against each other. The Waikato, the Kingitanga, they didn't want anything to do with the treaty. I remember reading and they said, oh, well, this is a sort of Ngāpuhi treaty. You know, it's not for us. And so on. And that's something that has changed then in the last 200 years, that there's increasing unity amongst Māori. That's never really happened, because that's, I think, necessary. I would say that for any people, if they want to get something done, they need to view themselves as a unified force, as one people. And if they view themselves as different tribes, then it becomes very difficult to get a deal.
That's right. And that's what Ratana, Tahu Potiki Ratana did, as he went with Tupu Taingakawa Te Waharoa collecting signatures all around the country on the treaty petition. He would say everywhere he went, are you united yet? And I think this is the same message. I think some of his prophecies about when the treaty is honoured, then Māori will come into a place of spiritual and physical prosperity. And he said that in 1921, before he went to England to deliver the petition to King Edward V, and got rejected because the New Zealand government said he didn't represent New Zealand, which was ridiculous because he had 40,000 signatures and there was 40 of them went across at their own cost. And you know, the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People recognises that Ratana and Deskahei, the North American Indian representative who went the previous year, are the pioneers of Indigenous rights in the world. We pioneered this whole, actually we need to honour treaties, we need to honour the rights of the people that were colonized. So there's a whole nother issue there. And the other one I wonder about is Ngāpuhi still have to have their treaty settlement in the far north. And they've said very clearly, we won't settle without a drama. And they're saying that we did not cede sovereignty. So I think that what we're seeing here with David Seymour and his bill is a preemptive strike on that claim. Don't ask me whether I believe that Māori ceded sovereignty or not. That is so complex. You'd need to read Ned Fletcher's The English Text of the Treaty of Waitangi. And again, we need both versions of the treaty to be able to reference to each other. We can't dismiss the English one and just go with the Te Reo version, because one is a translation of the other. We need to see, but it's just like the missionaries and the Māori, or Bible and treaty. We've got to find the balance between all of this. But we are at this intersection where Māori are saying, actually, this is the bottom line. The government's saying this is the bottom line. We have to find where the white line is in the middle and how not to run at each other in the wrong kind of way. We need a better negotiation around these relationships for the future, and we need it quickly.
And maybe a tricky question for you to answer then, how influential is Christianity still among Māori? Because if we look at the rates of Christian belief in New Zealand, it's decayed, unfortunately, and dropped down. And it seems to be the obvious solution, right, is that if there was some revitalization of Christianity among New Zealanders and, you know, both European and Māori, that would help solve a lot of problems, because then we would have that common foundation, we'd have that insight into the understanding of the Bible and what it would have meant to the people who signed the treaty and how they drafted that up.
I mean, all I can say is again, come back to Ratana, and between the two world wars, he healed the people, amazing healer. I just cannot explain away how many people were physically healed, and he called the people to come away from superstition and fears and the old gods and tohunga that were misleading the people, and to unite under Ihua or Nomano or Jehovah of the multitudes. So that was his solution, unite under one God. Doesn't matter about your denominational differences and all the rest of it. If you have a belief in one God, whether it's the, you know, Ringatū, King Tangitanga, Ratana, Christianity, they all believe in the same one God. So there's a good starting point. There's a common ground there. But we also need to, I think, have an understanding that Māori spirituality or Maturanga Māori, having a much more holistic picture, is a wonderful way of looking at this. We've got a common or a lot of similarities in our creation stories. So our origin, whakapapa stories, there's an intersection there. And if we discuss that and we understand that, then we're coming from a common ground. This is not the white God coming in on the missionary ships. It's an affirmation of this understanding that there is a creator and his purposes and his means are expressed through nature and through seasons and all the rest of it. But just coming a little bit further in my mind to understand Ihu Koraiti or Jesus Christ and what he brought, the fulfillment of the law, then we've got a wonderful example. He's not the white man's God. He's a Middle Eastern man who came and did what he did. And the whole story there is a story about resurrection, coming alive again, about the new shoot coming out of the ground and saying there's a different way forward. So that would be my message from Bible and treaty. We need the balance between the two. We need to honour our promises and honour God. And if you do that, then something will happen that I think is much more affable toward both parties. And David Seymour doesn't have a Christian belief, as far as I know. He wants equality for all. Well, I think we all do. But the reality is the treaty promised certain things to Māori, and we need to honour that. And if we're seen to be not honouring that, then how different is that from the multiple visits to England that Māori chiefs made over such a long period of time and were rejected, or the attempts at having kotahitanga, a parliament for Māori views to be heard by the government, which represents the crown. If we're going to do the same, so what's changed? 188 years of being ignored, I'd be pretty frustrated too.
Now, certainly, I can understand their view, and that's, I think, a difficult thing for people to do sometimes, but it's a wonderful thing to study history from the viewpoint of people who are maybe on the other side and to sort of understand their arguments and understand why they're upset, and that will help you have a better appreciation for both sides. And this is probably a completely separate discussion as well, but when you're talking about the Māori beliefs, and Thomas Kendall actually noted a belief in a supreme being, Io, and it seems to still be around today. And it's quite interesting to see how that came through, you know, all the way from the beginning, the echoes of Eden, or, you know, from the days of Noah, even that they sort of carried that belief with them. And that it's not that Christianity is the white man's religion, as you say, it's the fulfillment of all of these beliefs and that still came with the Polynesians and the creator. Mm. So that's a wonderful thing to, I think, a wonderful point to sort of end this on, since we are out of time. So I want to thank you very much, Keith Newman, for joining me on this interview. And, you know, your book that I really enjoyed, Bible and Treaty, Missionaries Among the Māori, A New Perspective. And please, before you go, could you tell people maybe where they could buy your books and maybe other books as well? Just any final words you might have as well.
Well, Bible and Treaty, Beyond Betrayal, more recently a reprint of Ratana the Prophet, can all be obtained from myself, Wordman, WORDMAN, at WordWorks, WORDWORX.co.nz. Send me an email and I'll get in touch with you.
Well, thank you very much. And to all of you listeners, you can send through questions and thoughts as well to 2057 or email inbox@realitycheck.radio. And we will be back right after this break.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.